Bathroom door, the only quiet place in the house. This is the Homeschool Sanity Show, a twice-monthly podcast with expert advice for happier, healthier homeschool living. And now, here's your host, Christian psychologist and homeschool mom of six, Dr. Melanie Wilson.
Welcome to this pre-Valentine's show, where our topic today is marriage tips for Christian homeschoolers. My guest today is Dr. Don McCullough. He is a Florida licensed psychologist and an associate professor of psychology at Palm Beach Atlantic University. He is married to his wife, Gwen, and they have four children. And I am really looking forward to getting to know him better. So, Dr. McCullough, please tell us more about you and your family.
Thank you very much, Melanie. And I, as you mentioned, I'm married, I'm a psychologist, and I think I often identify myself very much as a homeschooling dad. We have four children that we've homeschooled, and we came to homeschooling a little bit late, probably when my older daughters, who are now in their 20s, were in elementary school, junior high. We decided that this is something we wanted to try. It was really my wife's idea, of course. She's the one with all the good ideas. And the bright one in the family, and she said, let's try this. Particularly, we had one daughter that was struggling a little bit in the school system, so we prayed about it. We went to a homeschool convention, and it was really a life changer. We decided to homeschool our two older daughters through elementary school, junior high, and high school. And then I have two children that are teenagers right now. I have a daughter and my youngest son, and we homeschool them throughout their lives until one of my daughters reached high school age, and now we have two teenagers in high school. So that's a new experience for us. We'd never had kids in high school before, so we're learning all about that as well. But we pretty much identify as a homeschooling family for many years.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can share that experience with you because my oldest began high school as a junior. Now he is a senior, and it has been an excellent experience, and I was really, really worried about it, but it's been great, and I still have kids who are being homeschooled, of course, my five younger kids, but we share that in common, and maybe we could talk about that another time. That's pretty interesting.
That'd be
great.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know that you have done some research on homeschooling, which I thought was really interesting. I never did any research in that area because I was out of the field by the time I was homeschooling. But I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about that. What was the topic of your research and what did you discover?
Well, I'm very fortunate, in addition to being a practicing psychologist and doing a lot of marriage counseling, I am also a full-time professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University, which is in West Palm Beach. It's a Christian college. So I'm surrounded by bright, young psychology majors who are eager to be involved in research projects. And, of course, as I just said, I identify myself as a homeschooler. I was kind of curious about attitudes towards homeschoolers. And you've run into this yourself and those people who are listening who are homeschoolers. What are people's impressions of homeschoolers? And I must have had some of my daughters may have been applying to college at the time, or I don't know what exactly was the impetus, but I got this idea, and I got it through talking to some of the students. Sometimes there's this kind of idea out there, and you've heard this, that homeschoolers are very bright, but they're socially awkward. And I made up a term. I call this the dichotomous myth. May not be the best term, but it's the idea that, as I said, that homeschoolers are very bright but socially awkward. And what surprised me was that even some of the students who were working with me, some of whom themselves had been homeschooled, tended to endorse this idea. They tended to also kind of agree that that was the case. So I wanted to do some research and see if that was the case. But specifically, the topic of my homeschooling research was, did admissions counselors, those people who were working at colleges, whether they were Christian colleges or secular colleges, did they think that the homeschoolers that were applying, when they were confronted with a homeschooler applying to their university or college, did they think they were bright but socially awkward? That was my question.
Okay, and how did you go about looking at the answer to that question?
Well, that's it. I work with my students, and we came up with a survey that kind of addressed what their impressions were. So the topic, the title of the actual study was Admissions Counselor's Impressions of Homeschool Students. And we went about actually asking 60 admissions counselors who were at secular universities and 60 that were at Christian colleges or universities. So we had a total of about 120 admissions counselors. These are the people who review the applications for college and make decisions about them. And we asked 120 of them, and we asked them to take our survey, and the survey asked them what their impressions of homeschoolers were. And here's what we found out. We found out that, in fact, for the most part, this was their impression. This is not, there was no evidence that homeschoolers were actually were exceptionally bright or were socially awkward, but this tended to be the impression. Admissions counselors tended to think that homeschoolers were very smart, and that's a plus when it's admissions counselors. But some of them tended to have that either bias or that perception that maybe they were socially awkward. But as we did the research a little further, we found out that this belief, the second part, they all believed that homeschoolers were smart. So homeschooling has a good reputation in that department.
Mm-hmm.
But the belief that they were socially awkward tended to be held more among the Christian crowd.
Right. Which is a big surprise, right?
Yeah, I thought it would be the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I would have guessed that it would have been the other way around, that particularly secular admissions counselors who, you know, would have a more negative impression, and maybe they would say, yeah, they're bright, but they're social, but that wasn't the case. In fact, they tended to rate them much more normally and not see it so much as that. And what we found is that secular counselors tended to go strictly more on the basis of perhaps the data that they had or experiences that they had or knowledge that they had that homeschoolers were pretty bright. So they generally had a pretty positive view, whereas Christians who maybe have had some more experience with homeschoolers or had some of the same misconceptions that other people had, this idea that maybe they're socially awkward, that it was more Christians, significantly more Christians, who endorsed that particular idea.
That is really interesting. Now, do you know of any research that has actually tried to determine statistically, are homeschoolers more socially awkward? Have they ever, tried to rate them?
Absolutely. This is a question that's been around. And the answer is, I labeled this the dichotomous myth, because while there's some research and some amazing research about how above average homeschoolers tend to do on scales of academic achievement. In other words, academically, homeschoolers are actually excelling. There is no evidence, there has been no evidence ever, that homeschoolers are socially awkward or more socially awkward than average. Like, in other words, they're less than social.
Wow.
It does seem to be a myth. And they've tried to do this, but it's a very hard concept to measure, and I believe a lot of it is simply based on impressions or perceptions. And my explanation to the findings that we had to do with the fact that maybe Christians are more familiar with homeschoolers because they know more of them. Mm-hmm. And then they're more likely to kind of maybe categorize them this way, but not on the basis of any data. There's no research that suggests that homeschoolers are socially awkward. Matter of fact, the research probably points in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that really impressed me about homeschooling when I was just in the, learning phase about homeschooling is that homeschoolers have the highest self-esteem compared mm-hmm. to students who are in public or private schools. And that made a real difference to me because I felt like I did not have a great self-image when I was in school because of bullying. And I really wanted my own kids to feel good about themselves and not have to have that kind of an experience like I did.
I've read in the research would certainly concur with what you said. You have better self-esteem with homeschool. And, you know, it's funny. If you talk to, you're a psychologist, I'm a psychologist, and we take classes in developmental psych, and we learn about family. And one of the things they say is when you have a lot of involvement by both parents, particularly a father, you're going to create kids that have very good self-esteem, kids that feel good about themselves, have all the characteristics. And then the same people will say, well, you know, it's not good if your kids aren't at school. And it's like, well, there's no evidence that that's what produces the self-esteem, because everybody can probably remember junior high as being a real disaster. So I mean, it doesn't make
any
sense.
That's the truth.
If you want socially acceptable kids, you want them around adults and people who can talk into their lives and model, you know, good things. So.
Wow. I mean, this is such a fascinating subject that I feel like we could talk about this. Maybe again at a later date, just talk about, you know, what the research actually says about homeschooling and children's adjustment, because, you know, the father's involvement is not something that I took into consideration when I was looking at that self-esteem research. But that makes so much sense, because I have looked at the effect of a father's involvement on other areas, and it's, as you know, it's just so, so critically important to a child's success, really in every area. But that is really, really interesting, and I would love to talk with you about that again, because I think our listeners would really like to hear more about it. But one of the main reasons why I asked you to come and share your expertise with our listeners is to talk about marriage. And you have written the book, Perfect Circle, A Husband's Guide to the 6 Tasks of a Contemporary Christian Marriage. And it's an excellent, excellent book. It's a short book, which is fantastic for husbands, most husbands, right?
Right. Yeah, guys don't always read a lot.
Yeah.
So short is
right. Good. And especially on topics like marriage, they tend not to do as much reading on that subject as we wives do. But I loved it, and I did ask my husband to read through it, and we had a discussion on it. And I just wanted to share a little bit and discuss with you the first task that you say Christian husbands have is to invite their wives to the marriage of her dreams. Why is that so important?
Well, that's a great question, and it seemed to me that you have a lot of marriages that are sort of struggling. We have a lot of marriages struggling, and one of the things that happens is, as marriages struggle, sometimes the husband will get somewhat angry or frustrated in the relationship, and wives often feel depressed. They may feel like things are failing, and really, the idea of the husband inviting his wife to what her dreams are really is a way to kind of change the goals, to restart the marriage, to put the marriage in a better place, to get out of kind of this bind that they're in, where essentially what happens is the husband and wife are both sort of unhappy with each other. And I think, in reality, honestly, I think wives tend to try very hard to do what will make their husbands happy, and they're not happy, and it becomes very depressing, it becomes very frustrating. And one pretty simple, profound, yet, you know, not often done way to get out of that cycle is for the husband to just finally approach his wife and say, honey, what would the marriage of your dreams look like? What would it really look like in your mind? To ask the question of what would it take to make it be a happy marriage, and then for the husband to listen and to begin and see if he can start to implement some of those things. This is a transformative question. It's very important, but it's very important usually that it happens with the husband trying to ask what that is. What doesn't work is the wife trying to nag the husband into the marriage of her dreams. That just doesn't work. But
no.
The analogy I use with my clients is, if you have a ship, like a Navy ship, and the soldiers, the sailors that work under the captain, they may have an idea of where they want to go, and then they can try and suggest things to the captain, but really it's never going to happen unless the captain, who is actually the leader, turns around and says, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, sailors, where do we want to go? He's got to ask the question. If he asks the question and he takes the feedback, they can go in the right direction. But mm-hmm. a wife is never going to be able to nag the captain into where she wants to go. He is going to have to be the one to ask. But when he does, even though I start with the marriage of her dreams, it turns out that they will get to a marriage that they're both happy with.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Well, since that can be such a transformative question,
mm-hmm.
then the next question that I have is, why are husbands so reluctant to ask that question? It seems to me, anyway, that they are.
You know, why don't husbands just regularly come home on Fridays and say to their wives, honey, what would make a great marriage for you, and how can I start doing that?
Right.
Well, here's why it doesn't happen. First of all, remember, they're both a little frustrated. They may even be engaged in kind of blaming each other, so that makes communication hard. In his own way, the husband probably thought he had that conversation a long time ago. He may, in fact, really believe that he is working on the goals that she may want. Let me give you an example. A husband may be working extra hours to raise income levels with the real thought that this is what's going to make the situation happier for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on her dream, but she is complaining that he doesn't come home on time. So now we have this kind of idea that he's working on the dream, but then he feels he's doing it, but he isn't doing it successfully. It becomes almost like a sore subject. And let me answer directly why husbands don't ask this. Males like to do things that they're good at.
Mm-hmm.
This is very clear. I have a teenage son now, and it's been nice. I had three daughters and a son, and as I raise my son, I start to understand male psyche and my
yeah.
own psyche even better. And I understand that guys like to do things that they feel good at and they don't like to do, and they avoid things that they're not good at. And so if a husband gets the idea that this is what he's good at, he will go and do those things. But asking a question like this may be something where he can't control it, he doesn't feel comfortable with the answer, he's afraid. And even very, very successful individuals, males that I've worked with. I work in South Florida, and I work with a pretty high, what they call a high net worth individuals. These are people that are very successful in business and in certain areas of life. But then to go and ask their wife a question that relates to relationships is an area that they feel that they may not be as comfortable. They may not get an answer they want. It's just something they're not comfortable with, and so they avoid it. It's part of the male psyche.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. I asked my husband to, you know, go through this book with me, and he asked me that question. And I think he was surprised at how thrilled I was that he asked me that question. And
even though it was a setup, it was still thrilling.
It was a setup. Oh, yeah. Well, he's very used to setups, being married to me. But I think he was also surprised at how simple the requests that I made of him were. You know, I'm a very happily married person. There's nothing, you know, there are no major issues in our marriage, you know, things that we haven't discussed. He knows what, you know, what we tend to disagree about, which it isn't much. But, you know, just that simple question and just feeling like he listened to me.
Yes.
And was willing to, you know, put that effort in. Now, one of the things that he mentioned was, I think sometimes, and it's just kind of human nature, it's not necessarily related to marriage, but there is that perception that if I bend over backwards, quote unquote, to make you happy, I'm afraid that you're going to take advantage of me and you're not
yes.
going to reciprocate. And I have noticed that in him in the past, that he's worried that, you know, if I am just doing everything that you want, then you're going to think, oh, okay, you know, I've got it made. I don't have to do anything. And I've explained so many times, and I think many men don't understand this, that it actually works just the opposite. When you feel like your husband is concerned with your happiness and is willing to make some sacrifices to do what pleases you, then you're more than happy to reciprocate that.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. That is sort of the magic formula. And it's true. I mean, it is possible that it could be taken advantage of, but I don't see that in most cases. And as a matter of fact, like you said, the question is an easy one. What would make for your marriage your dreams? And you know, if we're talking about homeschool families, it might be if you could come home an hour earlier, if you could do the Bible lesson
mm-hmm.
with Johnny. I mean, something that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
the husband is out breaking his back, doing all kinds of things that really his wife never really wanted. And men are guilty of that. I mean, we can be sort of tunnel vision-like. And, you know, my wife has had to tell me that many times. The other thing is, let me just say this. I have seen this really be transformative in a couple other ways. What I tell husbands by way of incentive is if you can produce the marriage of your wife's dreams, assuming that she's a rational, reasonable person. You know, I mean, obviously there are people who could take advantage of it, but for most women, the requirements are not going to be that great, and they can be symbolic. If you do that and you really work on it, I think what you get in return is you can get a wife who can be so thrilled, like you said, I like that word, thrilled. They can be so excited and feel so good that they may turn around and say, honey, do you think you could just, you know, it's Saturday, it's a beautiful day, why don't you go play some golf? And, you know, that's really what husbands want to hear. But they're not going to get to, honey, could you please go play golf today, if they're fighting over what they're not getting in their marriage. So if one of
mm-hmm.
them starts getting
mm-hmm.
what they want in a marriage, and that person is like, wow, I'm happy here, what would make
mm-hmm.
you happy now? And while it is a natural tendency to take advantage, it also can be a natural tendency that if I'm being fulfilled in those areas that I really most value, then I could turn around and say, hey, what would you like?
Mm-hmm.
And it happens. I've seen it happen.
Yes, it definitely can work that way. Well, I am just wondering what some of the wives who are listening are thinking right now in terms of, you know, okay, Melanie just basically, you know, presented this book to her husband, and he asked her this question with some, you know, as you were saying, kind of a setup there where I had him set up to ask me that question. But what would you recommend for other women who just feel like, you know, he's not going to do it? How can I even get him to even look at your book? I mean, it's so difficult. You know, one of the things that works for me just because of how my husband is that if I want him to read a book, I just start reading it and I leave it like on our bed or somewhere where he
uh-huh.
usually is. And he always picks it up and starts reading it. But
God,
that's not going to work for everyone.
Well, that's not a bad technique. I mean, I think, you know, I agree. It's not. You have to, you know, ask your husband to read the book. I think you're right. If sometimes if a wife is reading the book and then kind of leaves it for him, is a good idea. I have a website, ChristianMarriageCoach.org, where I have usually once a week tips that I write for men. The chapters are relatively short, and there are questions at the end, and I have an acquaintance who's written many books for men and have been pretty big sellers, and he was the one who told me to keep the chapter short as well. That's why I did write
mm-hmm.
it in kind of a short. You know, there are just there's some basic ideas. The other thing you can do is you can go on Amazon.com and read the reviews. except for I think one woman, I've got about five men that have reviewed the book and have gotten into quite a bit of detail as to why, for men, it was helpful for them. So that's just one other suggestion.
Okay, that is great. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that are unique to Christian homeschoolers. I mean, they're unique, but not unique. Maybe we just have a little bit of a different spin on them. Mm-hmm. And I would like to get your take on what kinds of tips can you give us in dealing with these different kinds of challenges that make having a dream marriage difficult, okay? The first mm-hmm. one is time pressure. Of course, everyone has time pressure, but as homeschoolers, we can tend to have more depending on our life situation. How can we manage that?
I wish I could answer that question for myself. There's one thing that I've done, and it doesn't exactly answer the time pressure question, but it's something I learned while I was working on the book and doing some research for the book, and I met a couple out west. I had gone actually to a writer's conference, and I met this couple that seemed to have a really good marriage, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what the dynamic of that was. And I think this applies to the time question, pressure question somewhat. And that is, if you go to a marriage conference or if you go get some marriage counseling, one of the things the counselor is going to say is you ought to have a date night, and you'll hear mm-hmm. that. And date nights, I think, are very valuable. But date nights are not always what makes things – first of all, you got to get a babysitter, and mm-hmm. there's often a lot of pressure, and mm-hmm. it doesn't always go well. And so I have lots of clients who have had bad dates. And the date thing is hard to squeeze in, and it's time pressure, and then people feel guilty because they don't have dates. And what I have come up with, and I've had some feedback, I put this on my blog, is this idea of a coffee date, where a husband and wife have a set time during the week. If it can be in the morning, if you have flexible schedules, that's ideal. This is what my wife and I do. We meet every Thursday morning, and we have coffee together. But it's almost like a business meeting. We go over the things that are important for the week or in our kids' lives, and it's just set aside to talk about that. And this does help us with efficiency. We make decisions about what we're going to be doing this week, what's on the calendar. And if you can get on the same page, this can be very freeing. You know, just it's a means of communicating because sometimes time pressure is related to poor communication. And so it allows the couple to get together and just talk about the stuff that they need to talk about. And I usually like the couple, if they can, to go out, so that it's kind of a nice setting. So it's sort of like a mini date, but take away all the romantic trappings. And maybe some of the pressures to have a great time or to be real intimate. But this is a time to just get together and communicate and to become more efficient in running our lives and tackling the issues that need to be tackled. And we just don't have time to talk. That's the issue. We just don't have time to communicate and talk, and that's a big source of frustration, more so than time itself.
And I really found that it changes over the course of your marriage, the different seasons of your marriage, you know, what you need to do to deal with the time pressure. You know, now my husband and I have time together in the morning a lot. Mm-hmm. We get up with our oldest son before he goes to school, so that's a nice special time to have with him and also with each other once he's gone and the rest of the kids are not up yet. Mm-hmm. But then also just some time in the evenings when we just sit and talk. But
I agree with you completely, but the coffee hour in the morning idea is there because sometimes, and I have found this with homeschool families too, just the husband and wife are just exhausted at the end of the day.
Right.
And I was exhausted. My wife was exhausted. And it wasn't like we didn't want to communicate or we, like you said, we were mad at each other. It's just, we're just exhausted. Mm-hmm. And so if you schedule – And I'm very deliberate about this. And this is what I found in that couple that I met. They said, you know, every Thursday morning or every Wednesday, we go out for coffee together and talk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a concept.
Right. There is a concept. And, you know, I know some parents are going to be thinking, you know, I cannot do that with young, my little ones at home. And maybe you can't, but I was just talking with another, I wasn't talking with her. I just noticed it on Facebook. Another homeschooler who has actually been on this podcast before was saying that she has girls, she had a whole bunch of girls over for a sleepover because a bunch of parents get together and take time to keep one another's children so that couple can have a night to themselves. Now, as you're saying, it wouldn't even have to be a formal date night if that puts too much pressure on you. But just even having some peace and quiet, maybe you just want to sleep, right?
Well, yeah.
That could be good.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Well, let's move on to another problem that's really related to time pressure, and that's not having time for intimacy. I talk with a lot of women, and I get really, really concerned when they confess that they are not sexually intimate with their husbands on a, on a regular basis. And that's really a concern, isn't it?
It really is. And I find that to be very true with the people that I speak to, Melanie. And I will ask husbands about that, and they will say, oh, yeah, it's, you know, it's been, you know, months. And I get concerned because it's not really the biblical pattern, first of all, because I think that there's a potential for temptations and things like that. But I suspect often it's, you know, there can be, husbands can be exhausted. But again, here, I would, you know, this is something I do talk about in my book, and it's helpful if the husband can really, again, it would be nice if he would ask the dream marriage question, but it's also important for him to take some responsibility for, you know, maybe why they're not having sexual intimacy and providing that. And, you again, it's just like going out for coffee. You do have to be deliberate about this. This is perhaps part of the issue is I have found, this will be a little surprising, is that typically you might say, well, the wife isn't as interested because it's not a romantic situation if you have to kind of plan it. But I have actually found in the work that I've done that men are the ones that are much more sentimental about these things. They want things to happen more spontaneously, actually. Yes, in 25 years of marriage counseling, they actually are the ones that object and say, well, you know, if we have to plan it, that doesn't feel. And I have been shocked to learn that sometimes, well, I don't use the word romantic because husbands are not reading romance novels, but they can be very sentimental about things. They want things to be, the words I would use would be organic or just flow naturally. And it, you know, maybe it's not a gender thing. And so what happens is there's a resistance then to being very deliberate about sexual intimacy if we always have to subject it to the god of naturalness or spontaneity. And when you have multiple kids at home and you're involved in homeschooling them, you're just going to have to get over that and actually plan it out. So what you have to do is you have to go on your coffee date and do some planning over the coffee hour and say, you know what, we tend to talk in code about things. Well, it's been a while for you know what, so when would this be? And you may have to plan it out. And practically speaking, you know, it doesn't always have to be, if it has to be tied to going out to a date and getting dressed up, that may be true for some people. Some people are true romantics, and they're not going to be in the mood unless that's the case.
Right.
But I have actually found women, in my experience, to be much more practical. And they understand that this is a need. It's a part of a good marriage. They seek it as well. And so they would be willing in that conversation to say, when would be a good time to do this? What are the things that are the barriers that we need to deal with? And there often are barriers because with kids around and things like that, you know, you're going to have to plan this out.
Right. But you can find solutions, especially
Absolutely.
For you know, not forever, but solutions for the season that you happen to be in. And those seasons go by so quickly, don't they, Don?
They do.
It's amazing. You know, I can remember just feeling like I was drowning in kids and laundry, and it was overwhelming. And now it's like, wow, what happened? It's so much different. So that's an encouragement that I can give to you too, is that this too shall pass, and you will have time for more, as you're saying, more organic intimacy that just emerges as the moment occurs. Not to sound like one of those horrible commercials, but
right.
Yeah,
and, you know, we get upset because it isn't happening organically, but that's a bit of a myth. We can set some expectations up that just they're not happening organically with people that have 4 to 6 or 8 children anywhere.
Right.
It's just that's not the world that we live in. But it doesn't mean that we can't have a good sex life. It just means that we just have to be more deliberate about it.
Exactly. Well, since we're talking about that romance and intimacy, I'm interested in your opinion on Valentine's Day. What do you think about that? Do you think it's just a commercialized holiday, or do you think we should really be intentional about creating romance on that holiday?
Well, maybe not on that holiday, maybe on a regular basis if that's your personality. I think that husbands should be and wives should be sensitive to each other if they are romantically inclined. But this goes back to what we started with, Melanie, and you keyed in on something. You keyed on a theme of my book, which was invite your wife to the marriage of her dreams. And the way that happens is you have to actually go and ask the question and say, what would a dream marriage look like for you? And this is a good question to ask about Valentine's Day. What would a good Valentine's Day look like for you? And I know what my wife would say. She would say, no, I don't want to get dressed up and go to a fancy restaurant. I want a break. and then you can take me out someplace where, you know, it's inexpensive and it's just there's like no pressure. And to her, that would be an ideal Valentine's Day. And typically, my wife and I do not go out and celebrate on Valentine's Day. We give each other a card, but then in the card we might say something like, well, we'll go out, you know, when the rest of the crowd isn't going crazy. And so we're not as romantically inclined, but that doesn't mean that we don't do things that we appreciate. And this goes back to good communication. So my answer to Valentine's Day is, yes, it's overblown, but you can do a lot if you – it could be a prompt to a good question. What would you like?
I really, really like that. You know, what you're talking and writing about reminds me of the importance of the love languages too. I've found in my own marriage that my husband will often make dinner for me when he wants to be especially loving. And while that is wonderful and I'm always super appreciative, that's not my love language. That's his.
Perfect. Yep, perfect. Yeah.
And, you know, he knows it because I keep telling him. It's like, well, that's great, but, you know, this is really what I'm more interested in.
Here's an even interesting more twist on that. Like, along the same lines, if I'm, you know, wanting to please my wife, I might clean the house. I'll do house cleaning. And maybe some of your listeners would love to have me come clean their house, but what I learned years into my marriage was, well, I cleaned the house. It made my wife feel inadequate. Because if I have to clean the house, that means she didn't clean it.
Right.
So I wasn't getting the response I wanted.
Right.
So it would be more correct. So
yeah.
It would be more helpful if I said, honey, you know, what can I do to help you? What would make you happy? Mm-hmm. What would make for a good Valentine's Day for you? And she really doesn't. She said, you know what? I'm going to clean the house Wednesday, so just give that a break. But you could help me over here with this. And so it does go back to expectations and communications. And love language is a good start. As a matter of fact, I talk a little bit about the love languages in my book, because I talk about the fact that I think that that Gary Chapman had a fantastic idea there, but it's even more individualized than that. There
right.
are very specific things. So the love languages are very like gifts, but it's certain
mm-hmm.
kinds of gifts. Like, you know, and Gary Chapman does a very good job with that, but it's the way a gift is given. There's some specifics, and that's unique to each individual, right?
It is. Yes. In fact, when my husband and I had a conversation, I explained to him that it isn't so much what the gift is. It's more that I love surprises.
Right.
I just love that. And I said, you know, if you would just come home just out of the blue with like some chocolate-covered strawberries or just something that you saw that you thought I would really like, or, you know, you left me a little love note somewhere
mm-hmm.
where I would
mm-hmm.
find it, I mm-hmm. would go crazy for that. It doesn't have mm-hmm. to be, you know, a $50 gift. That's not what I'm expecting. So I think that's really helpful for him. But I think, you know, the obstacle there for many people seems to be that, well, if that isn't what I would like, then
right.
it's hard for me to imagine that it would really be meaningful to you. And I think that just takes experience.
Well, it does, but first you're going to have to ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be it's a lot of fun, and you are absolutely 100% correct that in my experience is just exactly what you said. The wife wants something. It could be a good book that I've always used with clients is His Needs, Her Needs, and I talk about that book in my book, but Harley's book, His Needs, Her Needs, and just whether it's domestic support, a little more help around the house. Maybe, like I said before, maybe if the husband would pick up a lesson with our kids that are being
mm-hmm.
homeschooled, or he would take the daughters out. I remember a few years ago when my daughters were younger, I know that was one of the desires of my wife. Her dream marriage was to have me, you know, take my daughters out for a date because she'd heard about that. And to her, that just seemed like an ideal thing. But that, to me, was not big on my game plan. And I would have never known, but she told me about it, and I did it. So it's things like that really can make a difference, and it's usually not a big thing.
Right. Well, this has really been wonderful, and I'm just now considering the fact that most of my listeners are women, married
right.
women. So what would you advise them today that they could do, just a small step that they could take today that would help to move their marriage closer to the marriage of their dreams? We've been talking a lot about the husbands, which is wonderful, and I really respected the fact that you said in your book that, you know, that's the group that you can address because that's where your experience lies as a husband. But I know you also give a few excellent tips in the back of your book for wives. So what would you suggest to a woman who's listening today and wants to do something?
Yeah, this is comical because I feel like if I try to speak to women, I get in trouble. So
well,
I am not an expert on females.
Well, how about this? You make your tip known, and then I will back you up.
wait to hear what I have to say.
Okay. Okay.
I think that here's a tip that both a husband or a wife can do, but I do see this as important for wives. You know, the Bible commands husbands to love their wives, and believe it or not, husbands don't do that naturally. I believe that that's why God commanded
mm-hmm.
them to do it, because it's something that they kind of need a reminder of. They need a command.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's crazy for women naturally love, so why would you need a command to love? That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But God commanded men to love because they need to be commanded. And I believe God commanded wives to respect their husbands because while they may naturally love, it is sometimes hard to respect their husbands. And here's what happens over time. I think that over years, if there's been a lot of disappointment and so forth, they may have kind of a low view of their husband. They may not have kind of a very high view of him. So perceptually, they may have kind of gotten into kind of a situation where they don't see their husbands perhaps as highly as they should. And what I have found is if they could just maybe change their perception as we go into February and have a more positive view of that, and just try to see their husband in a very good light. What I find is if a husband and wife begin to see that, there's really not a lot of downside to mm-hmm. that. In other words, even if this isn't going to lead to the changes you want, if he doesn't come around, if he doesn't purchase my book or ask the question, but if she can begin to see him more positively, she may in fact begin to feel and behave more positively towards him. And that's a way of being respectful by just even viewing him in a more positive light. And there's no downside to that, because even if there are things that need to change, and even if marriage is still a struggle, it's better when you're approaching someone and you're working or negotiating with somebody, you have a higher view of them. I do better negotiating with people when I have a respect for them. And so God knew that, and so He wasn't trying to put us in a bind. He just wanted to remind us, if we're a woman, that we need to respect our husbands, and we can do that by just thinking a little more highly of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be a bad idea for a wife to ask her husband what she could do to make him feel more respected?
That would be a great question. I really wish it would start the other way around.
I hear you. I do hear you.
I mean, it couldn't hurt. And, you know, if she does ask that, you know, she needs to really pray about it and mm-hmm. consider the answer that she's going to get. Because in both cases, whether it's the wife telling the husband what she needs to have a loving marriage, or the wife asking the husband what he needs for kind of having more respect, I think the answers are going to be surprising. They're not going to be mm-hmm. kind of what we thought. And I would just say, if you're going to ask the question, be open to the answer.
Mm-hmm. Very good advice. Well, Don, this has been fabulous. I know we have titled the show Marriage Tips for Christian Homeschoolers, but this is a podcast that I'm going to be sharing with any Christian married couple, because I think there's such wisdom that you have given us to reflect on today, and I really encourage people to buy your book. It's really, really excellent. I am going to put the link to Perfect Circle on the show notes for this podcast, which will be at ultimateradioshow.com. If you click on the Homeschool Sanity Show button at the top, you'll be taken to a list of the podcasts that I have done, and you will find Marriage Tips for Christian Homeschoolers there with all of the links that Don has mentioned during this podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with us today.
Thank you very much, Melanie, and God bless you.
Well, you too.
Thank you for joining us for the Homeschool Sanity Show with Dr. Melanie Wilson. Visit Melanie at psychowith6.com, that's the number 6, for more sanity-saving ideas. The Homeschool Sanity Show is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network.